Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We've got good, bad, and crazy news, all related to the president's address on ISIS from Wednesday night. And we'll have an excerpt of his speech for each of these martinis. First of all, Jim, the president giving the case against ISIS and then had pretty strong language to explain what the U.S. posture is against those who seek to kill Americans and harm American interests around the world.
Moreover, I've made it clear that we will hunt down terrorists who threaten our country wherever they are. That means I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq. This is a core principle of my presidency. If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven.
Jim, some may not agree that that has been followed through in every case in this presidency, but that's exactly the message that a president should be sending when America is threatened.
Yeah, I'm much preferring this kind of rhetoric from this president and these kinds of very clear statements from a commander-in-chief to the habit of ignoring the threat or downplaying the threat or dismissing it as a JV team or anything like that. I think there was really very little. Well, okay, we'll get to it in a second. But there was not a lot for anybody to object to in what the president said. The president's capable of giving a good speech. The real question is the will behind the words. And I guess that's a good segue to the next martinis.
Yeah, certainly is. So on to the bad martini. Now, the president laying out four different critical principles that would guide the U.S. policy towards the eradication of ISIS. But then he talked a lot about things that we wouldn't do and what the campaign would look like compared to other things we're doing in the world.
But I want the American people to understand how this effort will be different from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It will not involve American combat troops fighting on foreign soil. This counterterrorism campaign will be waged through a steady, relentless effort to take out ISIL wherever they exist using our air power and our support for partners' forces on the ground. This strategy of taking out terrorists who threaten us while supporting partners on the front lines is one that we have successfully pursued in Yemen and Somalia for years.
But that is not a good analogy, according to NBC's foreign correspondent Richard Engel.
I think it is wildly off base, frankly. I think it's an oversimplification of the problem. In Yemen, there is a partnered government that doesn't have the force to reach some parts in the desert where al-Qaeda is hiding out. In Somalia, you have a similar group to al-Qaeda, the same mentality that's operating in a remote corner of Africa that is generally ignored, except when the U.S. Special Operations Forces see an opportunity and target them. That's not at all the situation we are seeing in Iraq and Syria. Here we have a large group, tens of thousands of fighters. They control an area the size of Maryland. They control an area that has 8 million people living inside of it. It's much more akin to regime change than it is to wading back, picking targets with allied forces. They are not comparable at all.
On top of that, Jim, there are a couple other odd points in the speech on this. Number one, that he seemed to suggest that a political solution in Syria was right around the corner, and also that the Iraqi military was ready for a fight.
Yeah. there was, you know, it's interesting, as much as the rhetoric of it, of the speech was fine, the plan that seemed to be behind it really feels problematic, right? Unless there's some aspect to this story that's highly classified. And you hit one big point, which is that who's going to be our ground forces against ISIS? I have no doubt that the U.S. air power and whatever allies we can get to go with us will be a considerable arsenal. It is very tough to, and air power can be a, you know, key factor in a war. It very rarely is sufficient by itself. We now have this circumstance, you know, is it going to be the Kurds are fighting for us? You mentioned the Iraqi army. The problem with the Iraqi army up against ISIS before, I'm not sure how much of it was a lack of political unity in Baghdad. It may have been a factor. It may have been a sense that the Iraqi army was no longer a multi-sectarian force uniting the country. And the people in power in Iraq had turned it into a sectarian force that was, you know, loyal only to the prime minister. But ultimately, the issue was that ISIS was a brutal foe and the Iraqi military just was not up to the snuff. They dropped their guns and ran. And now ISIS has quite a bit of American military equipment, it sounds like. So it's hard to have a great deal of confidence in that. Now, maybe we can bomb ISIS into submission to the point where these other forces on the ground can overtake the territory, but it's not looking terrific right now. The president kept emphasizing how much he wants to have a broad coalition for this. But I understand, just apparently breaking this morning, Britain does not want to partake of airstrikes and Germany does not want to partake of airstrikes. So this doesn't feel like a big, broad coalition. It's worth noting, everyone seemed to claim we were attacking Iraq unilaterally back in 2003, and we had 45 nations. The idea that this is a larger coalition than back in 2003 doesn't hold much water, and that seems to be really central to Obama's philosophy on this. So Obama really seemed to think that we can get other parties in the region, that we can get the Saudis, that we can get the Egyptians, that we can get the Iraqis, that we can get people in the region to go out and do tough, hard fighting in hostile territory on our behalf. And it's really very far from clear that that can happen. And as they march through Iraq so thoroughly, there was obviously a lot of concerns about just how effective the Jordanian military would be against this, how effective Lebanon would be able to secure its borders from ISIS, the Saudis. You know, this is kind of a question of ISIS is probably one of the most formidable military forces out there. And you got to wonder if what the president prescribed last night is going to be sufficient against a force of this magnitude and ruthlessness.
All right, on to the crazy martini now, Jim. And the president, in his speech, obviously made reference to 9/11 being the next day, being today. And so that was appropriate. And he talked about a financial crisis that also happened in September, now 6 years ago, which was a little more of a stretch. But then he turned it into this.
Tomorrow marks 13 years since our country was attacked. Next week marks 6 years since our economy suffered its worst setback since the Great Depression. Yet, despite these shocks, through the pain we felt and the grueling work required to bounce back, America is better positioned today to seize the future than any other nation on earth. Our technology companies and universities are unmatched. Our manufacturing and auto industries are thriving. Energy independence is closer than it's been in decades. For all the work that remains, our businesses are in the longest uninterrupted stretch of job creation in our history.
He also went on to talk about how America is leading the role in fighting Ebola and keeping the Russians in check in Ukraine. Jim, it kind of went off the rails there.
Yeah, my colleague Ramesh Panuru said, I guess we should be glad at no point did he attack ISIS for not supporting equal pay for equal work, their opposition to gay marriage, and not raising the minimum wage. You know, that was a really off-key part. It's kind of striking that nobody in the White House seemed to recognize that on a wartime speech discussing the use of military force on the eve of 9/11 anniversary, it's not a time to be rattling off your economic happy talk, particularly at a time when people aren't feeling that great about the economy. Can't help but suspect somebody there was saying, hey, you know, we need this for the midterm elections. We need to tell Americans it's going great. And there are a couple of people who really kind of were saying, look, everything the president had said before, which was a long series of promises, if you offer something that seems out to lunch on the economy, do people feel more skeptical of all those other promises? As I said yesterday, once you've said we don't have a strategy, you really set a low bar for any subsequent speech. That if you offer anything that sounds like there's a speech, then by golly, people are going to say, all right, you know, we're doing better. But this president has really gotten tone deaf at certain times, and it's just unnerving that no one around the president can say, you know, Mr. President, it just doesn't fit the moment. Let's save that for some other speech.
Speaking of fitting the moment, we got about a minute or so left in our podcast today. And obviously it is 13 years today since the attacks on 9/11. For all the grief we give MSNBC on a daily basis, and rightly so, every year they just go back and play their coverage as it happened that day. And it really is gripping to once again relive that. And Jim, I heard a statistic a few weeks ago that those who are now college freshmen were kindergartners on 9/11, which means pretty much everyone younger than them either has fuzzy or no memory of that day at all. And it's really up to the rest of us to remind them what happened, why it matters, and how it influences us today.
Yeah, in a way, like it's funny how gripping it becomes, and how I end up catching almost at least part of it almost every year. You think I'd have other things to do like this, but it kind of, you know, you watch it, you get sucked in, you remember the little details of where you were and what you were going through your mind that day. So I have to salute MSNBC, and maybe every network, you know, might want to consider that, just because it feels like an appropriate way to remember it, to not just, you know, have a moment of silence, but to really, you know, think through a just utterly tumultuous and horrifying morning. Just to add to your comment about the passage of time, Greg, and it's a sign that you and I are becoming dads and getting older. There's this the crowd of people you follow on Twitter. I was in my early working days. I was working for a wire service at the time. I was wandering around Washington, really not knowing what should happen other than trying to investigate this report of the White House being on fire. And it turned out it was people seeing the smoke from the Pentagon. I'm hearing everybody talk about where they were in school on that day. And in some cases, grade school. And it just kind of makes you feel old to see that, and kind of a recognition that as horrifying as it was for us, I can only imagine how horrifying it must be for a child, kind of having a certain sense of how the world works and now having this unnerved sense that, you know, that we are not safe. Everything we experienced emotionally as an adult, having to be experienced as a child. Hopefully in the 13 years since then, we've helped create a world where our kids can feel a little bit safer. But I suppose with everything else, time will tell.
Well said. Jim, we'll hold it there for today and pick it up tomorrow. Talk to you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Please join us on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.